And I'm McKenna.
And together we're the Daily Profcast.
We're two long-distance besties
who share a love of Harry Potter.
We hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome back, everyone, to the Daily Profcast. It has been a hot minute since we just sat down and recorded about the book.
We had Erin Moon on last time. If you haven't heard our last episode, go check that out. If you did hear our last episode, but your episode got cut off in the middle for some reason, make sure you go back and check it out again. We had a little issue with a server that hosts our podcast and the file got corrupted. So we have re-uploaded the entire episode, but we lost a ton of listens because we had to re-upload. We would really appreciate it if you went back and at least checked out the portion that you didn't get to hear yet. Now we're back in the book. And we're picking it up at chapter 12, the Polyjuice Potion. So exciting. This is one of the most iconic parts of this whole story for Chamber of Secrets.
So we're going to discuss four chapters today. And three of these are some of my favorite chapters in the book.
Originally, we were going to finish out the book today. And then when we realized how in-depth we wanted to go for the last few chapters, we decided to split this up. We're doing four today and then three next time for the next episode. So McKenna, these are your favorite chapters. Why is that?
Well, rereading it, there's so many red herrings. So much built in and buried into these chapters. Things that are going to be really important in future books.
Yeah.
Things that are going to be important in the next couple of chapters.
Yeah.
The author has such fabulous skill in writing these very layered stories.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't deny that the way she built up to the end of the series is pretty brilliant.
Right. Chapter 12 is the Polyjuice Potion. Essentially what happens in this chapter is Hermione has been brewing in one of the girls' bathrooms a Polyjuice Potion for many months, and it's finally ready at the same time of the Christmas holiday. Draco has stayed behind, and Crabbe and Goyle, Draco's best friends, have stayed behind. So the Golden Trio decides this is going to be the right time to basically use the Polyjuice Potion and get into the Slytherin common room and find out what Draco knows about the heir of Slytherin.
Yeah. At the beginning of the chapter, Harry gets sent to Dumbledore's office after Justin gets petrified, and there he encounters the Sorting Hat, where he has a conversation about, why did you put me in Gryffindor and not Slytherin? Again, back to that sort of identity crisis he's having with what house he was sorted into. And he meets Fox the Phoenix, right, who he sees burst into flames and then get reborn again. So that's another really important part.
I think Harry encountering Fox the Phoenix, it's like a Chekhov's gun. It's a dramatic principle that you don't really necessarily realize at the time how important it's going to be. Dumbledore tells Harry three main things about phoenixes. Number one, they can carry immensely heavy loads. Mm-hmm. That's going to be hugely important, not once, but twice in the series again.
Yeah.
The tears have healing powers.
Yep.
Again, that's foreshadowing, going to be very important. And they make highly faithful pets.
Yes.
That idea of faithfulness and how they reward that. And that, again, is going to be important, not just in this book, but throughout the future of the series. Interesting the way she weaves in these little details about the Phoenix.
Yeah.
Specifically about Dumbledore's Phoenix, Fox, and how important he's going to be. And then I love that Hagrid bursts in.
Yes.
To defend Harry.
So just another testament to Hagrid's character.
So cute. And she writes that he's wearing a balaclava. I didn't know what that was.
Oh, did you look it up?
I did. It's a ski mask?
Yeah.
Why is he wearing a ski mask?
That's a really good question, actually. That's a really good question, McKenna. His balaclava perched on top of his shaggy black beard and the dead rooster swinging. Oh, was it because he was
killing roosters?
Butchering roosters? Is that when one wears? When you somebody who butchers roosters, tell us, do you wear a balaclava when you do it?
Like, interesting.
That,
right?
Is interesting.
Dumbledore asks Harry in this scene, do you have anything you want to tell me? In the book, it says Harry starts thinking about all of the things that have happened. He's hearing the voices. He talks to the snake during dueling club. He's walking through. And this got me thinking, is Harry really processing all the events that he should be telling Dumbledore, but he's not? Or is Dumbledore using Legilimens' spell on him in that moment?
Because it's all coming back to him in flashes. That's a really good question, McKenna. That's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. The only thing I was going to say about this part is I probably wouldn't have told Dumbledore that I was hearing voices either. I don't think I would have fessed that up.
Yeah, Dumbledore's the most powerful wizard alive. Wouldn't he want Dumbledore's help? Or I guess is he just so afraid that he's going to be seen as being the bad guy in this scenario?
I think I wrote a note in here, Harry Potter and the year that he was always in the wrong place at the wrong time. Because of everything that's happening to him this year, I think he's really going through, he was talking to the sorting hat about it not a moment ago. He's really going through this internal struggle of, am I good or am I not good? And I don't know it. I do think because he's seeing all these similarities between him and Voldemort, he's afraid to be perceived as a wizard who is destined to go down the wrong path no matter what he does. I think it's a matter of not wanting to put an idea in Dumbledore's head that he is bad, because it's something that Harry's struggling with right now. I wouldn't have told him either. So the Weasleys are all staying for Christmas again because Molly and Arthur are going to Egypt to visit Bill. And George absolutely calls it. He says, make way for the heir of Slytherin, seriously evil wizard coming through, which they're poking fun at Harry. Percy was deeply disapproving of this behavior. It's not a laughing matter, he said coldly. Oh, get out of the way, Percy, said Fred. Harry's in a hurry. Yeah, he's off to the Chamber of Secrets for a cup of tea with his fanged servant. Totally calls it.
I always appreciate when things feel very heavy, the way Fred and George are typically always the comedic relief.
Totally.
It's such a good character trait of the two of them. Yeah. Very astute observations, though made in jest.
Yes.
This may be more applicable to the movies, but once Ron and Harry take the Polyjuice potion, they keep their voices.
I want to talk about this.
In Goblet of Fire, Barty Crouch Jr. takes on Moody's voice.
Not only his voice, his accent, which is very interesting. We can talk about that when we get there. But as somebody who has a master's degree in voice, I want to talk about the vocal pedagogy and vocal physiology of this. In the books, Harry starts to talk and hears Goyle's voice coming out of him. In the film, there's that whole part where they go, we still sound like ourselves. That would not happen. If you're taking a potion that is completely altering your appearance inside and out, as the new person, theoretically, this would also change your laryngeal shape to be just like the person that you are transforming into, which would change the sound of your voice to their voice, because the sound of one's voice is based on the shape and size of their larynx and where it's positioned in their throat. If you're changing into somebody else, you should take on their voice too. That was a weird thing in the film that has always bugged me, but in the book it does say that he does speak with Goyle's voice. So, accurate.
We learn also in this chapter, Percy is sneaking around.
Yes.
Which it's something Malfoy brings up, actually. So, Crabbe and Goyle, aka Harry and Ron, go into the Slytherin common room with Malfoy. And the whole thing is a bust.
Yeah.
They don't
learn. Because Malfoy doesn't know anything.
Right. I feel like this is so typical of Draco, to act like he knows everything, but really not know anything behind closed doors. Right. But he does mention Percy Weasley has been sneaking around a lot.
Yeah.
He makes it sound more sinister than what we're really going to find out
what it actually is totally
doing. Yeah.
And by the way, we should mention, I'm sure everybody knows this, but Hermione didn't come with them. Hermione took the Polyjuice potion and remained in her stall. She said, you guys go, I'm going to stay here. And they said, okay. And so they went. And you're right, it is interesting. So Draco doesn't know anything, but in him not knowing anything, they find something out, because they rule out A, that it's not Draco, and B, that the person is probably not like one of Draco's cohorts, because Draco would probably be talking about it if that was the case. It heightens the mystery. They're like, well, who is it? If it's not a current Slytherin in our year. Now, I guess it could be a Slytherin in another year.
We do get something confirmed about Draco, and that is that he has awful views.
Oh, yeah. He's just spewing his, like, pure blood, nasty, racist rhetoric.
We discussed it in our previous episode. That is taught in the home, and that's obviously what he had enforced by his father and probably his mother as well. But
right, coming from the Black saying, family for sure.
Yeah, the things he's saying about Hermione, especially in particular, about how he wishes that she would be petrified or that it would kill her. It's so awful.
It's awful. I think back in middle school and how boys were in middle school, and people probably talked like this without understanding the full harm they do. Draco talks a big talk, but on the inside, he's just somebody who's hurting, which does not excuse his actions or the words he says. It's his way of how he presents to the world, and it makes him sound strong and stuff. So that was for you, Draco talk.
Draco does have an interesting redemption arc.
A little.
And it could have been a lot more. We've talked about this before. I mean, I do think he has these views because that's what he's being taught in the home. And of course, that's
copy-pasted on him from his father.
Right. And of course, that's coupled with his age and just his immaturity. The other portion is there's probably families who, I don't know, maybe Slytherin families, probably not just Slytherin families, who have these sort of pure blood ideals, but they don't act on them. It's just the stuff you say around the table. Not that that excuses it. But the problem is Draco is going to grow up watching his parents very much acting on these ideals.
Yeah.
I think it stirs up a lot of inner conflict in him as he gets older.
Yeah. Well, and that's, that's what we see, I guess, when we get to Half-Blood Prince. That's what we're going to see, is a lot of that inner conflict where he knows that it's wrong. He knows that he's doing something wrong, but he's a coward. Draco's a coward, and he doesn't have the strength to rectify it. Can we talk about how problematic it is that the Slytherin common room password is pure blood? Do we know if every single person in that house at Hogwarts right now is from a pure blood family? We don't know that for sure. Can you imagine being a Slytherin and going into the common room and having to deal with that?
Tom Riddle was not a pure blood.
Exactly. Snape was not a pure blood.
There's a lot of people. And again, I hate to make excuses, because I really like Snape because of the interesting character that I think he is. It's the same thing with Draco. They're not without fault, but it's their faults that make them interesting. Something I've noticed as we're on the TikTok community a lot more is TikTok's very divided between people who are like, oh my God, I hate Snape. He's the worst. He was horrible to the kids. And people who are like fetishizing Snape.
Weird.
In like an obsessive sort of way. What I think the middle ground is that he's a really interesting character and he has faults. So does Draco. And to say, oh, those people are horrible, they're awful characters, it's ignoring the humanity in all of us. We have all said messed up things. We have all done things wrong. And that doesn't have to be 100% of who you are. Nobody is like solely evil, except maybe and Voldemort, but and nobody is solely good all the time. I think that's what Harry's dealing with a lot in this book, is he wants to be 100% the hero and live up to that Gryffindor standard of where his parents were, who basically fought and died trying to defeat Voldemort. He's finding he has all of these markers of what society and the world has put on him that make him bad. Like, he could have been a Slytherin. He can talk to snakes. He hears these voices, and it's causing like an internal stir up inside of him. I think that's something we all do. It's really terrible, is try and make everything a black and white situation when the world is so binary. Many shades of gray.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really nice analysis. I've said this a million times. I know Snape is your favorite character and you are my favorite Snape fan, because you love Snape, but not without addressing the things that are problematic, or Draco, and I think that's so important when we're examining these characters, because again, you're right, we have to look at the fact that they're human, and it's not a binary. They're not all totally evil, all totally good, all the time.
Yeah, I don't think the author intended to write these characters in a non-human way, right? They're all supposed to describe different parts of humanity, and to hold them to an unachievable standard, I don't think that's how we're meant to examine these characters. It's like people who rave about James and Lily and how wonderful they are, and they are wonderful characters and they did wonderful things, but James also did a lot of not wonderful things in his life too. Again, shades of gray. It's all on a binary. I think a lot about little Draco, just how much he doesn't know. And you're right, that copy and paste onto himself. And it's very interesting as we're going to continue to go through these books to see his evolution as a human being and trying to find his own footing and his own values in the world. And I think that's so applicable to what a lot of people are going through, especially right now in our political climate in the US. You may have been raised a certain way by parents who believe a certain thing, but we're all on a binary, right? We're all just trying to figure out where we stand individually.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's a really nice analysis. And so they get back from the Slytherin common room and they go back to the bathroom to tell Hermione everything they just learned. And they realize that Hermione, who was trying to transfigure into Millicent Bulstrode, did not get Millicent's hair, but instead Millicent's cat's hair, and has accidentally transfigured herself into a weird, like, mutant cat thing. The chapter ends and Ron goes, wait till everybody finds out you've got a tail.
Can we talk a little bit about the fat shaming in the chapter as they were talking about Millicent, Bulstrode, Crabbe, and Goyle? They were just talking about, like, how big their clothes are, and they're all in the bathroom stall about to take the potion. And I think it's Ron says, we better all go into our own stalls because you know how big Crabbe, Goyle, and Millicent Bulstrode are. Like, we're not going to all be able to get out of the...
They're from the, quote, evil bad house. Like, fatness is equivalent to badness. Yeah, that is definitely problematic. When was this written?
99?
That was a little bit more acceptable in 1999 to say, but now we're looking at it through a 2020 lens and we're like,
Maybe Crabbe and Goyle were excellent intuitive eaters. That's why they just had so many sweets at dinner, because that's what their body told them to have.
There you go. But yeah, you're right.
So chapter 13.
The very secret diary.
What's interesting to me here is Hermione is out of school, or rather she's held up in the hospital wing because of the failed polyjuice potion, and it's taking time to wear off. She's going to be out again later in the school year. Still, by the time Prisoner of Azkaban starts, she's doing an immense amount of classwork. And yeah, she's obviously had a very successful second year. I think it just goes to show how brilliant Hermione is.
Totally. You're right. It's Valentine's Day.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. And Lockhart hires some dwarves to come in dressed like Cupid and deliver Valentine's Day grams and singing grams. One that gets delivered is Ginny sends one to Harry that is so, like, cringeworthy and also sweet.
It's so 11-year-old girl.
Your eyes. Harry doesn't want the dwarf that is delivering the message finds him in the halls, and Harry's like, oh my God, no, please don't do this in front of everybody. And Draco's there, and it turns into this whole big thing. Oh, but I'm sorry, we skipped over a whole thing. Go back to the bathroom and
Moaning Myrtle's crying because somebody has just come in and thrown a book at her, and they see laying in the water this diary. This is a brilliant Ron moment. I am rediscovering Ron in a major way because the movies have just done him such a disservice.
Totally.
You've mentioned it before. Ron has these very astute moments so many times throughout the series where he obviously is the one with the most wizarding knowledge, just like common sense, practical knowledge. Mm-hmm. And that is often overlooked, I think, by Harry and Hermione.
Ron is the street smart versus book smart argument. Like, Ron is like wizard street smart.
Harry wants to pick up the book, the diary, we later find out, and Ron says, you shouldn't pick that up. What if it has some sort of dark magic? What if it's tainted? And Harry, having grown up in the Muggle world, is like, no, it's fine. It's a book.
It's just a book. Yeah.
Ron, his father working in the ministry and just knowing the things that he knows, understands that, well, to wizards, a book doesn't have to just be a book. There can be something more sinister. And it's such an astute Ron moment and the way Harry kind of like laughs him off when Ron is totally right.
Yeah, absolutely.
On the diary is the name Tom Riddle on right. the back. Also on the back is that this was purchased in Vauxhall Street in London. Harry says, well, whoever this T. Riddle or Tom Riddle was, he must have been at least half muggle because he bought this on Vauxhall Street, which yeah. I think automatically makes him think this can't be related to the Chamber of Secrets being opened because this guy is half muggle.
Totally. The other thing is they see the name on the diary and Ron has a little bit of an epiphany. He goes, wait a minute, I know that name. When I got detention, I was cleaning the trophies off in the trophy room and this guy got an award.
Why wouldn't yeah. Dumbledore have removed this from the trophy hall?
That is a great question. Do you think it could be because this is a clue he leaves for Harry?
This is the question about Dumbledore. When we have these questionable decisions, is he doing this as a breadcrumb for Harry, Hansel and Gretel style, or was this an oversight?
As far as we know, Dumbledore still doesn't realize that Tom Riddle was the one who sicked. That's so weird because Dumbledore knows Hagrid's innocent. Otherwise, he wouldn't have hired him back.
Right, I think Dumbledore always knew Hagrid was innocent. He hired him to work at the school. And then he knows Tom Riddle's Voldemort. He's supposed to be the most brilliant wizard to have ever walked Earth. And he can't put two and two together and take the award for special services to the school out of the trophy room. So it has to be a breadcrumb for Harry, no?
Yeah, right? You would think.
Did he put Filch up to having Ron polishing the trophies as punishment?
When you think back on the events of Sorcerer's Stone, it's this trail of breadcrumbs that gets left for Harry and the trio to figure out the big thing at the end. This like little game that he's like set up for these kids. And it's going to teach them a lot of things.
It's also a game where you can die.
Totally.
Ron says one more astute thing in this scene. Yes. And he says, maybe Tom Riddle was given the award for murdering Myrtle. He says it, of course, as a joke because Myrtle is so annoying and she right. irritates everyone. But, yeah. but Tom Riddle ultimately is responsible for the death of Myrtle. Yikes.
Big yikes. One thing they recognize about the diary, so they bring it to Hermione and they try writing, there's nothing in it. If somebody has a diary and they put their name in it, shouldn't they have written some stuff in it? When Harry gets the Valentine, the dwarf grabs him by the ankles and there's a little bit of a struggle and he gets some ink spilled in his bag and this burgundy ink gets everywhere. But it does not affect the pages of the diary.
Yeah.
Harry's like, how is this ink not getting on the diary when it got all over everything else in my bag? And that's when he realizes that the ink gets like absorbed into the diary.
Prior to this, Harry's thinking he can't explain why he doesn't just throw the diary away because it's useless.
It has Hermation. There's attraction to it. Yeah.
But do you think the piece of Horcrux, the piece of Voldemort in Harry's soul is attached to the piece of Voldemort's soul in the diary?
Yes, I do. I do think so. I have not read Deathly Hallows in a long time, so I don't know how accurate to the book this is. But if you recall back to the film, whenever Harry's in the presence of a Horcrux, he hears this buzzing or ringing sound. He's got this spidey sense for the Horcruxes, so there's this magnetic force that sort of draws him to the Horcruxes, and I think this is our first time seeing it with the diary.
But of course, we don't know that at this point.
Exactly.
And I would have to imagine your soul pieces would eternally be wanting to get back together.
Yeah.
Right? Like, doesn't that just like make emotional sense to you?
Yes. We hear more than once in the series people talking about, you know, dark magic that can split things up, and it's unnatural. It is not natural for bits of the soul to be apart from each other. Even when we're talking about dementors sucking out people's souls, we think about the soul as this sort of intangible thing that's in all of us. But in this series, the soul is a tangible thing, which is very interesting.
Emotionally, it makes sense to me that they all would want to be reconvening.
Yeah.
Because the soul is just meant to be whole.
Yes.
I don't know. It's an interesting philosophical question. I have another question I want to pose to you. Which is funny. Somebody left us a comment that we always ask each other questions. And the truth is, Aaron and I don't discuss our questions ahead of the episode for each other.
This is literally just us talking, you guys. We don't plan anything. We're just having a conversation.
We read, we take notes, and then we pose to each other in real time questions. It's just authentic. Yeah. It's just two friends sitting down to have a convo.
No.
Does the diary work like a pensieve?
I think I wrote something down about that, actually.
So I researched a lot about this.
Okay.
The author was asked in an interview how a pensieve works. Does a pensieve record memories as you remember them, or does the pensieve record whole truth, right? Not your interpretation of something, but what really happened. We see with Slughorn, that's going to be much later in the series, but the pensieve takes in whole truth. That's how Dumbledore is able to know what Slughorn is saying is not true. That's Slughorn's fabrication of the memory. And it's meant to be that way. Dumbledore says it in 6, I believe, in Half-Blood Prince, that the pensieve is meant so you can go back into your memories and cycle through and dissect your memories and look at them for different ways. Dumbledore was skilled in the magic of ancient runes, and that's what it takes to construct a pensieve, is to harness that magic. And where Tom Riddle would have been, he was 16 when the Chamber of Secrets was opened, correct? He would have been taking or have taken ancient runes.
Ancient runes.
Right. And so it's my personal theory that I think Tom Riddle was emulating like a Dumbledore-esque style curiosity in trying to make the diary a pensieve.
That is super interesting.
And because it houses his memories, that's right. Why he was so attached to it and to making it a Horcrux.
That's going to make our conversation about chapter 17 in the chamber even more interesting. That's very cool. You said that and I was like, I swear I wrote that down when I was reading, and I did. I wrote down the diary has pensieve properties. So that's really, but I didn't do any research on it and you did. So great. That's amazing.
I feel like maybe I dug myself in a hole by saying that the pensieve records the whole truth and not just your interpretation. But I think Voldemort Tom Riddle, so manipulative that he's only showing Harry the bits of the truth that he wants Harry to see.
Totally.
But I do believe the whole truth is concealed within the diary.
Yeah.
As pensieve memories.
Interesting. That's super interesting.
My theory.
To continue examining. I love your theory.
I think that's what Voldemort was about. I think that's what Tom Riddle was about, was pushing the boundaries of magic.
Yeah.
To be what he wanted to be. I love Chamber of Secrets. It's a good book.
It's so good. I can't wait to get to chapter 17. I'll say it when we get there, but I think it's the most brilliant chapter thus far in the series. The diary starts talking to Harry. I would be a bit more freaked out if a diary started talking back to me, but he lives in a magical world at this point. So maybe Harry's like, anything goes, you know?
And he's attracted to it, right?
And he's got this attraction to it. So
he's trusting the memory.
Yes, it shows him the memory of Hagrid. He comes back, and Harry's first inclination, we don't really get this so much in the film. Harry's first inclination, he goes, oh my gosh, what if Hagrid did this? It was probably because he was trying to do it for the benefit of the monster, because Hagrid loves creatures.
Right.
So Harry is wondering if it was Hagrid's fault, but he doesn't immediately jump to Hagrid is evil and trying to kill people, you know?
He's so trusting.
Yeah.
He knows Hagrid's been expelled because we remember from the first book when Hagrid says, I'm not really supposed to be doing magic. Please don't tell anybody that my wand is concealed within the umbrella. Harry, I think, believes something like fishy is going on.
Let's examine this though, like Hagrid's character. Hagrid could never be somebody in charge of something called the Chamber of Secrets, because Hagrid is the person in this series the worst with secrets. He cannot keep his mouth shut when there's a secret, as evidenced by Sorcerer's Stone.
Right.
So this already does not make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. Yeah, I mean, it's a ridiculous of all the people to frame for this.
If you're going to choose somebody to frame, Tom Riddle wasn't looking at Hagrid's character. He was looking at his intelligence level. We don't even know. There's no, I say Hagrid's intelligence level, not because, you know, I perceive Hagrid to be unintelligent. I think Tom Riddle somehow thinks Hagrid's intelligence level is correlated with the fact that he's half giant, which makes him a half breed, quote, quote, in his mind. You know? So what a perfect person to scapegoat if you're racist.
I don't know that Hagrid has the highest IQ of everybody in the series.
No.
I do think Hagrid has immense emotional intelligence.
Absolutely.
Which is just as important.
Yeah.
It does say a lot about Tom Riddle's character. I mean, Tom Riddle, we know so much about his character that he has none, but it does say a lot about him as a person to use Hagrid specifically as a scapegoat.
Yes.
Hagrid has a giant spider.
Yes.
A creature with fangs.
Yes. Which seems to fit the description.
Just
not to mention the pincers. The best part of Half-Blood Prince. So good. Chapter 14, Cornelius Fudge, which I thought was kind of a weird title for this chapter. Like, yeah, Fudge is in it.
And no, because Fudge is in it, but I think this chapter introduces the idea of Fudge and how terrible he is going to continue to be. What we learn about Fudge and this character is a microcosm that explains the entirety of who Fudge is going to be. He's easily bought off. He's a coward. And he just goes with what other people want. He doesn't stand up for the greater good.
Yeah. Because he wants to be liked because he's a politician.
Right. Yeah. And I think he might just be a meek person. I don't have a whole lot of resounding respect for Fudge.
We learn that the mandrakes are doing well. They're throwing the stuff they talk about with the mandrakes in this book are hilarious. The mandrakes are maturing, but when they're talking about the mandrakes maturing, they're throwing parties, they're getting acne, they're moving into each other's pots. I just think that is so funny that they're talking about them in that way. Yeah, they have Easter holidays, they're choosing subjects for third year, and we, when they're choosing their subjects, we get this idea that, like, Harry doesn't really get any guidance.
I wrote a note here that this is the most Enneagram 9 energy of Harry, because he's just like, whatever, Ron, you pick, I'll just pick the same class as you pick. And it's so cute to me that Percy says he speaks so highly of his dad.
Yeah.
And Percy's so typically embarrassed of his family.
Yeah. So that's a nice Percy moment.
It is a nice Percy moment.
We get Hermione's brilliant quote, when in doubt, go to the library.
Yeah.
Iconic Harry Potter series quote. Then Harry has a Quidditch match. It is canceled. And then Harry and Ron get escorted to the hospital wing, where they find that when Hermione has gone to the library because she's just realized something, she ends up getting petrified. She is in the hospital wing petrified. And that is obviously very disturbing for Harry and Ron to see. They take the invisibility cloak, they go to talk to Hagrid.
And that's when we see Fudge, Lucius Malfoy, and Dumbledore. They all show up.
Yeah.
We find out Lucius is the head of the governors of Hogwarts.
Yes.
Do we think that's a fancy PTA?
Yes, absolutely. It's a fancy PTA. Lucius Malfoy is PTA mom in charge.
What's so depressing to me here is Hagrid is given no trial, no proper way to defend himself. He's just carted off to Azkaban.
Yeah. We're just going to hold you for a little bit, which at first we're like, okay, they're just going to take him to hold him. And this is one of the things that makes me wonder if Azkaban has like tiers or like levels of punishment, because we learn later Azkaban is a horrible, horrible, torturous place because there are Dementors.
Right.
Was Hagrid subjected to hang out with the Dementors while he was there, being held without, like you said, a trial or anybody examining his case? Because that's awful. And he should be seeking retribution from the ministry for that.
And again, this is the perfect introduction to Fudge, because I think this is who Fudge is as a politician. I think he's easily bought, easily swayed. He's all about appearances. Okay, Hagrid is supposedly behind the attacks. I mean, an ounce of digging into who Hagrid is would tell you that is absolutely not true.
Totally.
But he's the half giant. He's big and scary. He could look menacing. Okay, we'll just take him out and everything looks better.
He sucks. Fudge sucks.
I think that's why she named this chapter after Fudge. I think this is chapter in the scope of the series serves as an introduction into who Fudge is specifically.
That's a very good point. So Hagrid gets taken away. Dumbledore gets asked to step down, essentially. He leaves, which is for Lucius, who we later learn has orchestrated this whole thing, great. Because getting Dumbledore out of the way means a lot of people are in way more danger than they ever were. I would like to say another thing on Ronald's behalf. This is another instance of Ron is always the first one ready to stand up for those he loves. Malfoy goes, "I'm quite surprised the Mudbloods haven't all packed their bags by now," Malfoy went on. "Bet you 5 galleons the next one dies. Pity it wasn't Granger." The bell rang at that moment, which was lucky. At Malfoy's last words, Ron had leapt off his stool, and in the scramble to collect bags and books, his attempts to reach Malfoy went unnoticed. Ron was ready to like sock Malfoy for that.
And Draco and also says for standing up. That the new headmaster might not want the chamber closed if he's quote unquote decent.
Yikes. Guys, if you're from Draco Talk on here and you haven't read the books, you need to read the books to figure out who Draco really is.
Yeah, and again, I mean, spectrum.
Totally.
Not black and white.
Totally. Just not somebody you necessarily want to date.
I mean, just in general, guys, please stop the sexualizing and fetishing on TikTok of, number one, underage people or underage trying to sexualize professors.
I, as a teacher, have a huge problem with that. I've had to comment on people's things being like, this is pedophilia.
I have POV a huge videos. Problem as a human being with.
Yeah. Yes. It's not cute. It's not a good look. Cut it out.
It's gross. It's interesting Draco said that because it's ludicrous. Because Slytherins must have been headmaster before in the history of Hogwarts.
Yeah.
And Muggleborns were still allowed to attend and go to school. So I don't know. It's just Draco's squad logic. Constantly.
Yeah, and it's again, I mean, we do have to examine the fact that Draco again is a 12-year-old kid and he's just repeating the things he's heard at home. In a way, we can't excuse his behavior, but we also have to recognize that this is something that has been put on him.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, he is copy and pasted version of his parents' values, but
yeah.
Draco talks to Snape. I thought that was interesting about the headmaster position.
Right.
Which, foreshadowing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Snape will be headmaster.
Then we get an apology from Ernie McMillan, who talks to Harry and he's like, "I'm sorry I ever thought you were the heir of Slytherin. You wouldn't have petrified Hermione Granger."
Okay. I hate the spiders.
You hate the spiders?
I
love the spider part. I think it's a fun part. Before Hagrid gets carted off to Azkaban wrongfully, he says, "If anybody needed to find some stuff, follow the spiders." What the heck? And then they find this trail of spiders. And Harry's seen a trail of spiders before, earlier, like around an attack. There's just spiders filing out of the crime scene or whatever. They see the spiders going towards the Forbidden Forest. And Harry says, "Let's go." Ron is really hesitant, not only because there are spiders, but because we need to remember Ron has never been in the Forbidden Forest.
Right.
Ron was in the hospital wing when they had their detention for getting caught with Norbert. Ron didn't go with it. In the books, Ron has never, up until this point, been in the Forbidden Forest. That's an added level of scariness for Ron. I have a question. Here's another question that I'm asking to McKenna.
How dare you?
Harry and Ron were not the only ones in their dorm. They shared a dorm with Neville and Dean and Seamus.
Right.
Did they just never rat them out when they were out of bed? Or did they put the curtains around their bed and then the other boys thought they were already asleep? There are so many instances where Harry and Ron are sneaking around the school and did the other guys just not tell on them?
I don't think they do because remember when they, in the beginning of the book, when they crash the Fort Anglia and they get back to the dorm and all the boys are cheering them on because they think it's the best thing ever?
That's kind of true.
I think the boys are in the morning, they're like, "Oh my God, what did you guys get into last night?" You know?
Yeah, maybe. That would be sort of on brand for at least, but like Neville?
I think Neville's gotten used to it.
Yeah. Oh, Neville. But yeah, so that's just a query. They go into the forest, they take Fang, they see the car before they get to Aragog's lair. They see the car. Oh my God, the car's been living wild in the forest. They go into Aragog's lair, they meet Aragog. And Harry's first inclination is, oh my gosh, it's the monster from the diary. They start talking to Aragog, and long story short, Aragog tells them what they already suspected, that Hagrid was not the one opening the Chamber of Secrets, and Aragog was not the monster. But he's not all good either.
No, so I wrote this down in my notes. He talks about eating humans, but he's only ever lived in the Forbidden Forest. So who is he eating?
Yeah. Doesn't Hagrid come visit him? Aragog's not all good. He goes, you know, I gave you guys the information, but I'm hungry and my kids are hungry. So gonna eat you. Luckily, the Ford Angular.
What would have happened if he ate him?
In the end of the series, it would have sucked.
Would Hagrid have ever been able to forgive him?
Oh my gosh. Probably not. Oh, that's a sad thought too. Yeah, but also messed up that Aragog was like, I know you guys are Hagrid's friends, and not thinking about the repercussions of Hagrid being angry about it. That's a good point. The Ford Anglia luckily comes to the rescue and drives them out of the forest. I just want to mention Ron's fear response. We know Ron has like a trauma that goes deeper than just like arachnophobia. He is traumatized by spiders because of childhood experience. He hates spiders. And his fear response in the books is way more legit than that they put in the movies. In the books, he's like speechless and shaking. And like, that is a way more legit human fear response, I think. And then they're analyzing what they were talking about with Aragog. And Aragog mentioned, you know, somebody was killed in the, did he say in the bathroom? Ron, that girl who died, Aragog said she was found in a bathroom, said Harry, ignoring Neville's snuffling snores from the corner. What if she never left the bathroom? This is when they realize that Moaning Myrtle was the creature from the chamber's victim 50 years ago. Yeah. And then they realize they can go talk to her about it, which leads us into chapter 16. We're addressing chapter 16 next time.
Okay.
Yay.
We did
it. I love you.
I love you too.
Have a good night.
Have a good night.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for listening to our latest episode. As always, please subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. And if you're not a listener on Apple Podcasts, it would still help us out a lot if you head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. If you have any questions, comments, concerns about anything you heard in this episode today, please drop us a line at our Anchor profile. You can leave us a nifty little voice message there, or you can head to our Instagram @thedailyprofcast to DM us or leave us an email. Thank you.